would you like to get property financing with private lending? Matthew Medrano will tell us how to do this. And what's so special about Matthew is he is the managing partner and CRO of Dynamo Capital, a private lender based in Kansas that specializes in both short-term rehab loans and long-term DSCR financing. With a background in economics, real estate, and commercial lending, Matt has built multiple multi-million dollar pipelines while helping investors access flexible capital solutions outside traditional channels. And in just 2 years of founding Dynamo, they have become the number one private lender in Kansas with 30% of market share, and they achieved this by solving the middle market problem. Offering 30-year fixed DSCR loans for 510 unit properties, entity-only lending, and creative tools like cross-collateralization and portfolio consolidation. So, Matt, tell us about how entrepreneurs can get property financing with private lending.
Property Wealth Strategies podcast with Lily Patrashko shares world's most influential property investors, sharing their strategies for making money with property.
Yeah, sure. So, private lending, I think, has a lot of different connotations, whether it's hard money, I've heard mob money, private lending, private finance, creative finance. There are so many different terms. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's common sense lending to, you know, business purpose entities and deals that make sense. So the short answer of how an entrepreneur gets a loan with us is they have a good deal that makes sense, and we're happy to fund it.
Thank you. So for listeners who may not know you yet, can you tell us about your journey into real estate lending?
Yeah, well, it's a corkscrew of a project to get into how I got into lending. But so I started out once I graduated college. So I'm from Wichita, Kansas. When I graduated college, I moved back to Wichita to work at Koch Industries, which is the main, one of the largest companies in the country, and certainly the largest company here in Wichita. Everybody that I knew ever that was successful worked at Koch. And so that's where I wanted to go. To be clear, that's Koch Industries is in pretty much makers of everything, not Coca-Cola, not the soda. So I worked at Koch for all of a cup of coffee. I worked there for about 2 months. And on day one, I knew it wasn't for me. It was a giant machine, one of the best machines in the world from a business perspective, and I had a ton of respect for what that company is able to do and continues to do, but I knew it just wasn't for me, that I couldn't have as meaningful of an impact on day one that I wanted to, and I didn't have the patience to slowly climb the ranks at Coke and ultimately be able to drive the change that I wanted to drive. And so very fresh out of college, I decided that it wasn't a fit for me. And I got into the world of IT sales. So selling like data centers and storage solutions and backups and all that stuff to enterprise style clients here in Wichita. And I found that I really liked the sales business. For context, at Coke, I was a financial analyst that was drilling down into the, you know, the dollars and cents of every invoice and receipt that was collected for a couple of the plants that I was overseeing the work on for the reporting. And ultimately, it just wasn't for me. So I got into enterprise sales, found that I really liked relationship selling and owning an account and managing an account and spending a bunch of time, entrenching myself into an account and learning what the needs were and meeting those needs. Unfortunately, we were bought by a bigger company very early on in my career there. And in any merger, right, a good chunk of the efficiencies that are gained from that merger are letting go of, you know, the younger group and the less established group. And I knew I was going to be in that class of folks that were let go. So I got into foundation repair, which is a really big deal here in Wichita. We have a extremely gummy, is how I would describe it, clay soil, and a lot of foundation problems that come with that. And so I started working with real estate agents, fixers, flippers who were doing rehab projects that needed foundation repair on their homes. So think leaning walls, bowing walls, leaking basements, et cetera, that are really frankly scary issues on the surface. I mean, to see a basement wall leaning in 4 inches is a pretty scary sight for a potential buyer. And so there was really good spreads for real estate investors who knew what they were looking at to buy that house have an opportunity to rehab it for less than the perceived value of the issue. So they were finding good spreads, and I was starting to work with a lot of investors that were working off of that model. Right around then was COVID. I refinanced my home with my now business partner, Justin. He crushed the mortgage rates that I was getting quoted and did a phenomenal job for me. And we started a referral network where I realized that there were a lot of properties with high mortgage rates, or high at the time mortgage rates. I think to be great mortgage rates today, the threes, the fours, the fives, that wanted to get down into the ones and twos that were during COVID. And the people needed project money to work on their homes for my foundation business. And so Justin and I started a referral network back and forth, where he was refinancing projects for me, and I was using that cash out refinance to actually complete the project from the foundation side. And so we had a good referral network. After a year or so of kind of flirting about coming over to the mortgage space, he wanted me to work with him as a lender. I wound up rage quitting one day from job and jumped over to being a residential mortgage broker. As soon as my license cleared, rates started to hockey stick up from the twos and threes that they were to the sevens and eights that you see today. And so, you know, naturally we needed to find places to continue to do loans. Less people were doing loans at those higher rates. And so I had a lot of these business style clients that were underserved through the traditional means of Fannie and Freddie, and especially here in Kansas. You know, we were one of the only mortgage brokerages in the state, let alone the only like business purpose lending mortgage brokerage, which is an even tighter class of specific class that people would be in. And so we started brokering those loans. And here we are today. So we started as a brokerage where we were lending via these kind of call them institutionally backed East and West Coast firms that did not understand the Midwest here in Kansas at all. That our $100,000 property in Kansas was not only a good property, but it was a meaningful income producing property, and it wasn't a slum. And so we were brokering those loans, but ultimately we weren't getting the attention or the prioritization that we felt we deserved, from those bigger lenders. And instead of waiting for those lenders to see the value in us, we decided to create the value ourselves and started our own fund, so that we could fund those projects ourselves. And then that brings us to Dynamo today.
Thank you. So what inspired you to start Dynamo Capital and focus on private lending instead of traditional banking?
Yeah, so private lending, like I said earlier, there's a lot of different terminologies for it. We were brokering private lending style loans through, like, for example, Kiavi or Lima One or Lending One. Those were the kind of the main shops that we were brokering to at the time. But the reason that we started Dynamo specifically is because those shops were still nationwide and did not have an appreciation for the Midwest or a prioritization on the Midwest. You know, at the end of the day, a lender gets charged or makes their money based on the total loan amount and the origination fee against that loan amount. If you could do $500,000 deal in Destin, Florida, or $100,000 deal here in Wichita, you know, which one are you going to do when there's only a limited amount of bandwidth that you have? And ultimately, we were getting deprioritized in that capacity. And so we just felt like the only way for us to serve our clients best was just to figure out how they're doing it or do something similar and provide the money directly from ourselves.
Thank you. And just 2 years, Dynamo became the number one private lender in Kansas. What do you think drove that rapid growth?
Well, it's twofold. You know, the majority of private lending here in Wichita and Kansas in general is mom and pop shops. So people that recycle the same $3 to $5 million and lend it out, and they do really well for themselves and they have really deep connections with their borrowers. And I kind of consider them more like a rich uncle for those borrowers. There's a very short list of borrowers that they serve because there's only a limited amount of capital that they have to go around with. What has driven our success here, I would think, amongst other things, but from an economics perspective, is the scale at which we are. You know, we've raised about $60 million in equity and manage a fund north of 100 and 100 or so million dollars, which means that we have scale beyond most mom and pop shops and the ability and the bandwidth to grow with a client as opposed to being constrained to the same maybe $3 or $5 million that they're lending out. And so that's what's driven the success here in Kansas. But also, I mean, frankly, there's not many players here in Kansas, so it's not hard to be at the top of the Kansas stack. But that's why we're focused on the Midwest. The story here in Kansas is very similar to the story in Iowa, Wisconsin, all the way down to Oklahoma. And so there's a thirst for this type of lending here in the Midwest, and that's what we're going to quench.
Thank you. What kind of investors benefit the most from private lending?
Well, I think there's a lot of use cases for private lending. Investors, so we have really two sides of the house. We have borrowers and we have investors for the sake of this conversation. The investors in our world, they inject their capital into the fund and then we give them a monthly return. Now, I don't think that question you're asking, I think you're more from a borrower perspective. The borrowers that have success here with Dynamo are ones who, our clients are bankable. They work with banks, but they've hit their limits with the banks, whether the bank gave them $2 million and that's all they want to be lending out at a time, or they've hit their exposure limits here or there. We typically don't have those same constraints. So borrowers that have the best success or investors have the best success with us are clients that have hit their limits with other banks or other facilities, and they need access to more capital, or the ones that want to stretch their dollar further. One of the things that we're known for is high leverage lending, i.e. 100% loan to cost lending and up to 75% ARV. That's a little bit different than the standard market. You maybe see something at maybe 80% loan to cost up to as aggressive as 100, but typically stops around 90, 95. By us filling the capital stack all the way. And so when I mean 100% loan to cost, I'll give you an example of a deal. Let's say you're going to buy something for $100,000. You're going to put $50,000 into it, and it's going to be worth $200,000 when you're done. I will lend you the full $150,000 you need to both purchase and rehab that property up to the $200,000 value. In other scenarios, in the more standard scenario, you're going to see lenders want to see maybe 10% down on the purchase, 15% down on the purchase. If you're a bank, maybe even 20% down on the purchase. And that's just not how we think about lending. We typically focus on filling the capital stack for a borrower so that they don't have to go and find an equity partner to help inject, somebody to help carry the monthly payments or anything on those lines. We want to, because they can't cover the monthly payment because of the amount of equity they have to inject into a deal. So we have a very different philosophy on that front. So borrowers who want to stretch their dollars more and that want to scale their business, those are the ones that we're focused on.
Thank you. So tell me, why do you do that?
Well, first off, it's something that nobody else is doing at, that's not true. There are other folks, other lenders that do 100% loan to cost lending, but we personally like it because you get, first off, a very pleased client that doesn't have to go out and stress about finding additional capital to fill their deal up. If it's, an equity partner or they have to continue to raise. And so we like having to be a one-stop shop for a client. That makes us very comfortable. And also from a loss mitigation perspective and a protecting collateral perspective, we're not worried about somebody going out and getting a second position lien against the property because they want to fill the rest of their capital stack or they're in that position that they have to. So it helps our deal stay cleaner and it helps us be more comfortable. Also in the Midwest, in that scenario that I gave, if you put 10% down on the purchase, it's $10,000. I submit for you that $10,000 is not making or breaking a deal in this scenario. And so what's the point of having them put down an arbitrary $10,000 into the purchase? I don't believe that, quote unquote, skin in the game from a down payment perspective impacts the ability for a client to perform or is related to the ability for a client to perform or their willingness to perform. I think all borrowers in general want to perform on their properties and then exit cleanly. At the end of the day, what we're selling is a successful exit of their project. And we try to do that the most efficient way for their capital.
Thank you. You offer 30-year fixed DSCR loans. Can you explain what DSCR financing is?
Yeah, so it's in stark contrast to what we've been talking about so far. So we were talking about the short-term bridge product before, where they're typically six-month loans, where you're going to be in and out. But then one of the exits to those bridge loans is a refinance. And so the refinance piece, when you're mentioning a DSCR loan, DSCR stands for debt service coverage ratio. So effectively underwriting the property from a rental perspective based on the money that the property is going to be producing, the income that the property is going to be producing against the proposed mortgage payment that you have on that deal for a ratio, AKA the DSCR, the debt service coverage ratio. In another word, from an investor's perspective, in my opinion, it's really what's the cash flow of that property look like? You know, if you have it's intuitive. If you have $1,000 a month mortgage payment, you as a landlord are not charging $1,000 for the rental payment. You're charging north of $1,000 because you have to make the payment and then you have to make some cash flow on top of it. And so the golden rule for our ratios is we want to be for the best pricing. We want to be at like a 1.15 or 15% cash flow over the top of the monthly mortgage payment that you're looking at. So those DSCR products are just a fancy way of saying a 30-year long-term rental mortgage is all it is.
Thank you. So how is DSCR lending different from the way banks evaluate borrowers? Is it what you said earlier?
Yeah. So in the DSCR world, I'm interested in the asset itself and not necessarily the borrower. And in our case, the borrower is always an entity, an LLC or of some kind. It's not the actual human. The human is the guarantor, but the human is not the borrower. In the traditional Fannie Freddie world, you're typically lending to the borrower or the human itself. You're capped, certainly in the Fannie Freddie world, at 10 properties. You're looking at your taxes, your W-2, your income that you make on a monthly basis, you're submitting paychecks and all the underwriting gunk that you have to go through in the Fannie Freddie world, which is what we used to broker the loans through, right? We used to broker through Fannie Freddie. We had NMLS licenses, we still do. But we would do the traditional USDA, FHA, conventional, those types of loans. And there's a lot of paperwork and a lot of headache for the borrower. And if you're an entrepreneur, you're a self-employed borrower, if your accountant's doing a good job, you don't make any money on paper. From a Fannie Freddie perspective, that's a problem. And so it's a really fine line. If you're a really good operator from an accounting and a tax perspective, then you don't necessarily look great from a lending perspective in the Fannie Freddie world. Enter a more business purpose lending forward lender like ourselves that's interested in the asset. We're asset-based lenders at the end of the day. We want to know how well the property is going to perform, and then that's how we decide if we're going to lend on something or not. And so it tends to be a lot more common sense than the traditional lending infrastructure that most people would be used to.
Thank you. Dynamo focuses on the middle market investor. What do you mean by that, and what problem are you solving for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to what I've been saying already in terms of the middle market, meaning the Midwest, the smaller borrower that doesn't have access to, you know, a coastal focused lending shop. I mean, a lot of these bigger shops, they're institutionally backed. They're backed by some kind of Wall Street component or a hedge fund or a REIT or any number of bigger institutional style backings. At the end of the day, Dynamo is focused here in the Midwest. We had a deal that I'll give you an example. We have a deal in Topeka, Kansas today. A traditional big box store, I'll call them big box store, but like a national player lender is only willing to give this client 80% loan to cost on their loan because it's a secondary market. It's the capital of Kansas, but is considered a secondary market overall, right? I mean, Topeka, if you blinked, you'd miss it when you're on the highway. But for me here in Kansas, it's a primary market. It's not a secondary market. So that when we're talking about the secondary, the middle market client, they're ones that are in less or underserved markets already that aren't big priorities to the bigger box store lenders because ultimately they want to do business in the Carolinas or the Californias of the world and you know the bigger states, the Floridas, the Texases. We're happy to do loans here in the Midwest because we understand the Midwest asset. And generally, the premise is that Midwesterners want to work with Midwesterners. They want somebody that's in their zip code, or not their zip code, their time zone, for God's sakes. I mean, we were brokering we rarely had somebody in the central time zone that was our account rep. It was usually an East Coaster that was covering us, or maybe they got kicked out to the West Coast and somebody from California was, you know, wasn't willing to pick up the phone till 11 o'clock to deal with us.
Thank you. What challenges do investors usually face when trying to scale their portfolio with traditional banks?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the big challenges you'll always find is that you're capped at the 10 properties. That's a Fannie Freddie rule. So if you want to have a big portfolio, you can't do it through Fannie Freddie, or you have to be very, very creative. And I think that's a pretty loose term. You know, the other thing is too, like it's just a lot to manage. And the underwriting process is very, very dense because you're still, again, qualifying based on yourself and the property. And in the business purpose world, you're lending based on the asset. The Fannie Freddie world, the residential standard residential model, is just not built for an investor that wants to move quick, wants to be efficient, and that wants, flexibility in how their loan terms are structured. The Fannie Freddie world's very, very consistently square and solid. And it is institutional in the sense that like it's always going to be there and the guides are very clear. But there's just not as much common sense that can be applied and as much negotiation of guidelines that you can apply here in the more business purpose lending world.
Thank you. Is the private lending you offer a lot more expensive than traditional banks?
Well, I mean, that's a loaded question, right? On the surface, the terms are more expensive, but that's from a rates and fees perspective. We're never going to be cheaper on rate than a bank for our short-term stuff, but we're certainly giving more leverage than a bank. And if you're having to go fill the capital stack with a 50% equity partner, we look very, very cheap compared to a bank, right? So it's not just the terms that you're getting on the specific deal that you're really comparing the total cost of. You're talking about the entire cost to do a project. And when you start to compare that holistically, I would argue that we're very, very affordable compared to everybody else in traditional banking and whatnot. But at the end of the day, we charge a premium price for a premium product. There has to be a cost associated with closing, a fix and flip loan in 5 business days. There just has to be, right? If you want to take 30 days to go do it with the bank and pay an extension fee or miss out on a deal because somebody bought it with cash already, I would argue that's a much heavier fine than, a marginally higher interest rate or a marginally higher origination fee.
Thank you. How can investors use DSCR loans to move from one property to a full portfolio?
Yes, I mean, I think the key here is just to stretch your dollar further, right? And be able to get into a property in a sensible way. Most of our borrowers, for example, are using short-term bridge loans to rehab a property and then refinancing with the DSCR product. There's certainly a world where you're just purchasing in the DSCR product right out of the gate. But honestly, I find that less and less common because of the spread that you can make in the equity that you can build into a property by rehabbing a property and then refinancing it with the DSCR product on top of it. So, scaling a portfolio is much easier in the DSCR world just because you don't have to have, you don't have to have the W-2 or the tax return to support that in the traditional underwriting sense that, that Fannie and Freddie would require. So I think that's where the big difference is for scaling the property portfolio is.
Thank you. Is this private lending that you offer suitable only for U.S. Investors? And do they have to show any particular documents to make the deal happen?
Sure. So yeah, well, it is hard money in that I'd like to ask no questions and give out all the money. We do have some guidelines and rules around how we do it. We work with foreign nationals. We work with I-10 borrowers. There's a lot of nuances there, especially here in the Midwest. There's a, believe it or not, a pretty significant population that's not always a U.S. citizen or a U.S. borrower. So there's plenty of time for us to look at stuff like that. I'd say that's on a case-by-case basis that we'll do it, but we're happy to have a conversation about it. I would say from a guideline perspective, company to company, Dynamo is going to be one of the more open lending shops that's out there that's more interested in the nuance of a deal and willing to go beyond what traditional private lending is willing to do. So that's how I'd answer that. In terms of what's document, like what's required from a documentation perspective, it's really mostly the asset that we're interested in. So obviously we want to see the, you know, basic documentation around the borrower, so the LLC, the Articles of Incorporation, the EIN letter, all these things. Our needs list is probably 10 things long. We'll get some form of valuation on the property. We will validate the scope of work, make sure that everything on that front that makes sense. And that's pretty much it on the short-term side. From a DSCR perspective, really the main thing that you add there is that you want to see a lease. We want to see what it's leased for and get a valuation and get a traditional appraisal on it at that point. But again, it's very common sense. The underwriting requirements coming from the residential full Fannie Freddie world, it was like this. Over here, it's much more akin to this. And even for a repeat borrower, it's a lot more like this because we've already done the work on that, on the entity, and we've done a lot of the heavy lifting. So you get a lot more scalability and that flywheel really starts to roll with repeat borrowers, which is our main goal, is to have a bunch of repeat borrowers that are happy to come back to us and do a bunch more deals with us. Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to sell is scale.
Thank you. Do property investors need to show any documentation related to what they make in terms of income or, properties they own or anything else like that?
No, that's the whole beauty. Again, we're asset-based lending. I'm not interested in what your W-2 is, right? Of course, I'm interested in that you can make the payment and all those things. But what you make, the component of what you make in this world that we're interested in is what's the rental income going to be. Right. And obviously for the short term piece, we're not interested in any of that. It's about the spread that we're going to have between purchase and rehab to the finalized value. But on the DSCR front, I could care less if you work a $2 an hour job or a $200 an hour job. It doesn't mean anything. If you don't have an asset that's not going to produce rental income to match the mortgage or exceed the mortgage that we have on the property, then there's no point. And so that's the main focus, is what's it going to rent for? What's the proposed mortgage look like? And how do those relate? What's that ratio? Hopefully it's north of one. There's very few cases in which you want to be less than one, or we're willing to go less than one. There's certainly a case to be made for sometimes. But generally speaking, yeah, like I said, you want to be north of that 1.15, I think is a good metric for everybody to shoot for. Because if not, what's the point?
Thank you. Can you give us some case studies of creative financing you have provided for property investors where perhaps generally they wouldn't be able to qualify for a traditional bank loan or a mortgage, but you were able to help them out and now they have built from, I don't know, one property to 5 or 10 or however many?
Yeah, I think so. I'd switch gears a little bit in terms of the product that we talk about, but I think my favorite stories are always the general contractors who have built and built and built and built houses for other developers, or contractors in general that have done work for other borrowers, builders, developers, whatever you want to say, that are tired of making everybody else money with their product and say, well, why can't I just do this myself? And they're traditionally unfinanceable because they're rookies. They've never built a home themselves. Now, they've been the GC that's really doing all the work. From a common sense perspective, they're the reason those houses are built, not the borrower in the past, but the borrower somehow gets the credit because they signed their name on the documents, and the borrower gets the credit for the work that the builder did. Here at Dynamo, we will absolutely use prior general contracting experience, general building experience that shows a track record, and then lend to that borrower at the same rates and terms that we give, you know, our quote-unquote experienced borrowers. And so that's one of the biggest case studies that I would cover, is that, you know, we have a lot of those borrowers that we're empowering who are first-time investors in some cases, that have a significant track record working for everybody else, but now they actually get to work for themselves and create value that they get to keep as opposed to giving away to somebody else. So those are my favorite stories. Any of the common sense stuff that we do that other lenders won't, I think is always, you know, there are a lot of arbitrary rules and systems in place in the lending world, in both traditional lending and then even in the business purpose lending world, where somewhere along the way, everybody agreed that a 680 credit score was the minimum credit score that they were willing to work with in the business purpose lending space. If you could explain to me the difference between 679 and 681, I'd be happy to hear it, but there is no reasonable explanation, right? FICO and the credit scoring system is kind of arbitrary in the first place anyways. And then, you know, to set 680 is the hard deadline, and no borrower under 680 is worthy of our money. But anybody that's just barely over 680 is all of a sudden magically better than that borrower over here. It doesn't make any sense. So on our short-term stuff, we don't have a minimum credit score. This is something that we think is pretty arbitrary and silly. And so we'd rather look at a credit file based on the merits of their credit. If you have a 400 credit score, explain to me why you have a 400 credit score. Right? Did a medical situation come up and blah 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 and you're clawing out of it? I would argue that the 600 credit score that's on its way up from 400 is far better than the 660 credit score that's on its way down from 800. There's a case to be made for anything, and common sense lending requires that you look at the nuances of each deal. And that you don't just have arbitrary guidelines, and it's a little less scalable, right? Because we look at everything individually, but it's artisanal, and that's how we'd like to do it.
Thank you. Are you saying that you also do private lending for property investors with really bad credit score in the way that you've just explained?
Yeah, because I think really bad credit score itself is an arbitrary term. Look, we're not giving away money to everybody. Right, but we want to understand why your credit score is the way it is and if it's indicative of your ability to repay our loan. At the end of the day, everything we do from an underwriting perspective is how well can you repay this loan and exit the property. We had a borrower, his credit score was very, very poor. He did not speak great English. And on this credit report, I mean, his credit report was very close to our area code. And the area code here in Kansas, or Wichita, is 316. Just give you an idea of where that credit was. When we look at the credit, and on the surface, that is a terrible credit score. No one would in their right mind lend to that person, right? But when we started to look at why the credit was, he had maybe 20 accounts that were very small, between $20 and $100, I would say. Nothing really north of that. And they were all consumer stores, Kohl's, TJ Maxx, Ross, right? Just pretty much an entire shopping center, right? Dick's Sporting Goods, Shields, all these places. And it was very apparent that he was getting sold the, would you like to apply for financing and pay half of this today or whatever, you know, the spiel was. And he was signing up for these credit cards, not knowing he was signing up for credit and then not ever completing the payment. And so no one, I don't think, had ever taken the time to explain it and go, hey man, do you know that you're doing this? When we told him that, we actually took the time to read him his credit score, the consumer copy of that credit score, and explain to him what was going on. He goes, oh my God, I didn't realize this was happening. We could have easily denied this loan because it was a, you know, very low credit score and just sent him on his way just like every other lender, but that's sloppy. We took the time to explain to him what was going on. That is a borrower who has entered and exited a loan with us, done a phenomenal job, and is a lifetime borrower of ours in the future because we took the time to help him out, and now his credit score is trending up nicely. I would really push back on the term bad credit. Everybody has a story. We just want to understand what that story is and explain the nuances and help people out.
Thank you. Does that mean people with, let's say, a bad credit score because of certain circumstances, do they get a worse interest, like a much more expensive one?
No, not necessarily. Nope. We risk adjust pricing based on the case. In the case of him, I didn't feel he was a risk. We told him what was going on. We had open line of communication. I also have a Spanish-speaking LO here who does a phenomenal job, who was able to meet him where he was at. And we have Spanish-speaking servicing. We have support throughout the entire process there. So I felt like we were going to do a really good job with this borrower. We did. He exited well before the maturity date, and it was a really good deal for us. So No, he didn't get risk increased pricing or anything along those lines. He paid the normal rates and fees. He's a really happy borrower with ours, and he's looking for his next deal today.
Thank you. Are there common mistakes investors make when structuring financing for multiple properties?
Well, there's common mistakes across the board. Multiple properties or single properties, you still see the same thing. I think the biggest mistake that you see in the DSCR world is when calculating a DSCR, you take the lesser of the current leased rent or the market rent as it's appraised. For example, if I have a property and I have it leased for $2,000 a month, but the market really says it's worth $1,500 a month, and I just happen to have a sweetheart lease where my renter is overpaying me technically. I, as the lender, am going to calculate your DSCR based on the market rate of $1,500 a month, not the $2,000. So your cash flow might be, your DSCR might be a two, start with a two, according to your calculation based on what you're actually getting. But for me, it's maybe going to be closer to 1.5 or whatever that calculation winds up being, because I'm at 1500. And I have to look at worst case scenario for the market. And so if that renter ever leaves, you're only going to make 1500 when you go to put somebody else in, because the market should be putting in a $1,500 renter, not a $2,000 renter. So I think that's the biggest mistake you see in the DSCR perspective, is just not understanding how we calculate the DSCR.
Thank you. Tell us about short-term rehab loans. What should investors know before taking on a value-add project?
The mistake that I see there, which we are always guarding for and we're always helping investors see the light in, is understanding and accurately projecting what your after-repair value is going to be. Every investor, in my opinion, always has rose-colored glasses. They think they can get the property for cheaper, they can do the rehab for very, very cheap, for very low cost, and that the ARV is going to be through the roof. And so that scenario I gave of 150 and 200, that deal works at the current numbers that I gave. But if rehab all of a sudden is $75,000, that deal doesn't look very good anymore. If the ARV doesn't come up to match it, right? So if you have a purchase for 100, you're going to put 75 into it, it's going to be worth 200 when you're done. There's $25,000 worth of spread, but that's hardly worth your time over what you're risking in the purchase and the rehab component of it. So projecting the rehab budgets, coming in on budget and not overspending, cost overruns are killer. And then also projecting what that ARV is going to be is paramount. Because if you think you're building a $200,000 asset, and you can only sell it for 180, we're going to have a tough day when you owe me 150 plus the fees and interest and all those things, and it gets to look like a break-even type project. And so very important that you project your ARVs correctly. We walk alongside you to do that, and we have a lot of tools to be able to project that. And we've had really good success over, one, knowing the markets that we're in and knowing what the future values of projects are going to be. Helping you get in and out of projects without having any extra additional capital to exit them.
Thank you. If someone wants to scale from 5 units to 50 units, what financing strategy would you recommend?
Obviously the DSCR product, because you're uncapped there, right? You can't go through the traditional lending world to get to 50 properties, and there's just no way in the Fannie Freddie world. So the DSCR product is uncapped in terms of the amount of exposure that you can have. And for me, the best way to scale the business, in my opinion, is to focus on building equity into properties with a high cost or a high leverage lender, so that I can build in the equity into my properties and the refinance. I mean, in a perfect world, you could get 100% loan to cost loan from me on the front side, and then you could refinance in the DSCR product. And have to inject no equity into that deal. You would build the equity yourself, which helps you keep that free cash flow and set up more capital. So in a world where cash is king, high leverage lending is certainly a big key to retaining cash and utilizing it for other purposes, or, to keep projects moving, or to, real estate is all about speed. And so having cash in your bank that you can go and pick up a property quickly, if you don't have a loan on it, is a really nice perk to be sitting on.
Thank you. What's the biggest mindset shift investors need when moving from traditional bank financing to private lending?
That's a good question. Like a shift to scale. When you're talking about traditional lending, you're talking about moving slowly and expected timelines between 30 and 45 days. The traditional underwriting package, all those things. The biggest shift that you'll see when you come over to a more business purpose lending base background lender is more focus on the actual asset, the common sense associated with it. Some of the traditional things that would get you through a loan on the residential side or the traditional lending side are totally irrelevant. I don't care that you have a big W-2. It doesn't do anything for me. On the business purpose side, you can make millions of dollars, but if the asset doesn't cash flow, it's not a good deal, and we're not going to do it, as it sits. So, focusing on the asset as opposed to the borrower, I think is a huge shift that people would have to have coming over to the business purpose side.
Thank you. How can property investors mitigate the higher cost of private lending? Is there anything they need to put in place to make sure that the money they get with private lending works for them?
Yeah, I mean, I mitigate the high cost of private lending. I don't think is a bad premise personally. But there are obviously, you don't want to be in my loans for very long. You want to be in and out, right? So having your team ready to go, having a set of contractors ready to go and a smooth system on that front, very important. Very important that you have a plan of action. You don't want to sit on my loan for any longer than you have to, right? We're charging 12% annualized interest in some cases. You don't want to pay an extra point a month. You don't, but that keeps the churn of that capital really, really fast. So you want to have all your ducks in a row before you get into a private loan, before you get into any loan. No one wants to pay interest, but the stakes are much higher on the private lending side with a higher interest rate coupon. There just are.
Thank you. Tell us where property investors can connect with you.
Yep. So super simple. Go to dynamocapital.com. There's a borrow link. You put in the basic information that you're looking for, and one of our loan officers will reach out to you. Depending on where you're at in the region of the country, we have a lot of local hubs, if you will, that we try to funnel loans to specifically, so they have some context. Yeah, dynamocapital.com.
Thank you. Is this kind of private lending only available in your local region, or is it available across the entire US?
No, we'll in nationwide. We have a proclivity for the Midwest, just because we know it really well. We're much more aggressive there, and we look much better because there's less coverage or less options you have here in the Midwest. But we're happy to mix it up nationally. We save a few states that we don't have a license in or care to get licensed in, and we don't do business in those states. Yeah, we would look at really any deal that comes up. And then, if we're legal and licensed in that state, then we'd be happy to do the loan there.
Follow me for more property wealth strategies.